You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby. CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Underrepresented music, local voices, and real people. You keep CJSF independent.
CJSF is completing a multi-year project to replace our broadcasting tower on top of Burnaby Mountain. It's a costly but necessary project that will set us up to reach our community across Greater Vancouver on the FM airwaves for many years to come. Help us rise higher and reach further with a supporting donation to our Fund Drive campaign at cjsffunddrive.ca or text DONATE to 778-782-2573. With your support, we are up, up, and away to a better future.
I think what's important is that it is more than you. That you have a team of people, and the more you broadcast the voices of the community, that whole community rallies around you. You are definitely not alone. That's the power of community media.
That's Amy Goodman, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Amy Goodman on the power of community media. In a time of polarized politics, the role of independent community media play an increasingly important role. Big media are owned and controlled by large corporations. Their salient interest? To make as much profit as possible for their shareholders. That is its political economy. Given that acute limitation, it makes it difficult for most people to get information that challenge mainstream perspectives. By featuring diverse voices and views largely excluded, community-based media provide an alternative to corporate McNews. To talk about the power of community media is one of its foremost practitioners, Amy Goodman. She's the award-winning host of Democracy Now!, the daily syndicated radio and TV program. Howard Zinn said of her, "Amy Goodman has carried the muckraking tradition of Upton Sinclair, George Seldes, and I.F. Stone into the electronic age, creating a powerful counter to the mainstream media." She gave the keynote address of the National Federation of Community Broadcasters meeting in mid-June in Salt Lake City. And now, Amy Goodman.
It is so wonderful to be here to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the NFCB, of the National Federation of Community Broadcasters. How many? The oldest and largest national organization dedicated to community stations within the public media system. This is our neighborhood. But really, the whole world is. That's the power of media. I see the media as a huge kitchen table that stretches across the globe, that we all sit around and debate and discuss the most important issues of the day. It is our job to go to where the silence is. Often it is not silent. It is rowdy. It is raucous. People are organizing, but it doesn't hit the corporate media radar screen. It's our job to go there. That's the power and why there is no more important moment than right now. You all represent the hope of the future. You all are the clergy of a sanctuary of dissent, and dissent is what will save us. public media, even the corporate media, is under attack because all media is essential to the functioning of a democratic society. And ultimately, that's what's under attack. And so you have to take apart the pieces. You've got to unbuild those building blocks. The absolute foundation of a democratic society. But that's not the only story that's going on here. It's all of the people around this country who are fighting back. And that is our role, to give voice to those who are organizing. How many times corporate networks call us, can I have that number, can I have that number, can I have that number? Because, you know, they go to their self-appointed leaders, or so often you just get that same tired small circle of pundits on these networks who know so little about so much, explaining the world to us and getting it so wrong. I think the power of Democracy Now! And the stations, the programs on all of your stations, is people closest to the story telling their stories. That's the hard work. But it isn't as hard as one might think, because community radio stations are made up of those people. And that's what's so important, who may not have access to the corporate media, but who make their way through the training programs, through the open doors of community media, and we can't let those doors close. We've got to keep the microphones on. You know, I've often criticized the corporate media for being a stenographer to those in power, but even they right now are balking, to say the least, as one network after another, from CBS being sued by President Trump for billions of dollars for editing an interview with Kamala Harris, for editing a long interview where she's got allergies and she's coughing and she's sneezing. You know, we sort of, this is our standard practice in newsrooms when you have to cut an hour interview to 10 minutes. I can think of all the times I'm standing telling someone, no, you need to cut another minute out. And it's not for political content. It's to, you have to get something because there are so many people that need to speak. So that was not going to go anywhere, that suit. Except if media outlets, the most powerful ones, are owned by corporations that are owned by corporations that are hoping to merge with other corporations, they have far more interest than a newsroom, which probably doesn't make them the most money. And so they have other concerns. And even if they know, they're going to win that battle in court. But they can win the battle and lose the war. And the war for them is merging with another company that will make their shareholders more money. This is the real problem with corporate media, and a real problem when they are the ones who are supposed to be the standard bearers of freedom of the press. They're just caving for their economic interests. Or you have ABC. George Stephanopoulos, right? He says on television, one of their star hosts, that President Trump was found guilty of rape in a trial. And so President Trump sued. Now, what is true is while it was a civil trial found liable for sexual assault, the judge in the case said, in common parlance, that is known as rape. ABC could have taken this way up the judicial chain. But they felt, even if they could have easily won that, they would lose so much more money around their corporate investments. Look at people like Bezos, who owns the Washington Post. Of course, he owns Amazon, too, one of the billionaires standing at President Trump's inauguration. When they're going to endorse Kamala Harris, said, no, we're going to stop endorsing presidential candidates, right, in the lead up to the elections. Now, I think there's a lot of arguments to make for and against endorsements. I think that's a legitimate point. But if the reason the publisher of the Los Angeles Times and the publisher like Bezos of the Washington Post doesn't want the endorsement is simply because it might go against the person who will win and they want to be in good standing with him, that is a very serious problem. We have so much work to do, and you are the standard bearers as nonprofit media of that critical pursuit of truth. And what I also want to say is, it's not exactly truth with a capital T. People have so many truths, and it's that diversity that we also celebrate and provide a platform for, that we all learn from. If we don't know people personally, how do we learn about them? We hear them or watch them in the media. And that's how we learn about other countries. That's how other countries learn about us. And it's absolutely critical that that lens be something other than a corporate lens, how we're projected to the rest of the world and how the rest of the world sees us. That is a matter of national security. Why, what you're doing here is so noble, is so important. It's a matter of life or death of this democracy in the United States today. I don't think that's too much to say. Who is in our community? Who do we get to know? People we'll never meet in person, but we hear them speaking. Maybe ideas we absolutely disagree with. But, oh, that's why they think what they do. Which reminds me, one year of the Nobel Peace Prizes, we were broadcasting from Stockholm. And we spent a week, and we talked about Sweden, you know, is the home of the Nobel Peace Prize. And, of course, Alfred Nobel is the inventor of dynamite. We talked all about that history. It is the second largest weapons manufacturer in the world. It's hard to believe that place that the great Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg just went home to after she went on that Gaza flotilla and tried to break the Israeli blockade on Gaza with a dozen other activists and a journalist. Absolutely amazing. And you might know and actually have heard the voice of this young woman talking to us from the Gaza Freedom Flotilla as if she were in our studio. That's what they all want to shut down. That's what we all have to fight for. Because let's be clear, I really do think whether we're talking about the Israel-Palestine conflict, whether we're talking about larger issues of war and peace, whether we're talking about racial justice, economic inequality, LGBTQ issues, whether we're talking about the environment, those who care about these issues are not a fringe minority. They're not even a silent majority. They're the silenced majority, silenced by the corporate media, which is why we have to take the media back. That's why the National Federation of Community Broadcasters is so important. Each one of your stations is so absolutely critical. That those voices of dissent, those voices you hear around the water cooler, become commonplace. They are not dangerous. They're essential. Whether you're a Palestinian woman doctor who's lost 9 members of her family, or an Israeli peace activist whose mother and father were killed October 7th, you are hearing what they have to say as they actually unite and they talk about fighting for peace. Whether we're talking about a Palestinian child, an Israeli grandmother, an uncle in Afghanistan, a child in Salt Lake City, we are breaking down barriers and caricatures when people speak for themselves. The media can be the greatest force for peace on earth. Instead, it is all too often wielded as a weapon of war, which is why we have to take the media back. And it is most often wielded in that way by the silence, by the voices you don't hear. I remember in the lead up to the Iraq War, when most people in this country were opposed to Bush's war on Iraq, right? It came out of 9/11. Were there any Iraqi hijackers of those 19? How is it possible that that justified the war in Iraq? And how is it possible that when the networks covered that war, how rarely we heard an Iraqi voice. I'm not talking about the leaders. I'm talking about people on the ground. Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, knows the power of those voices, which is why he has forbidden international journalists from going to Gaza unembedded. Forbidden. Most networks don't say that very much. And I want to say, there are so many journalists inside the corporate media as well. I bet many of them came from community radio stations who are committed. But they get funneled, we call it up, and suddenly they find themselves, sometimes they think, well, I could reach millions of people, so this is worth it, the compromises that are made. And some of them fight royal battles inside their news organizations, and some of them leave, and some of them stay and try to do the best they can do. Mahmoud Khalil. He was taken, I think, on March 8th, you know, the graduate student at Columbia University. So this was soon after that. The Trump administration's nationwide roundup of international students accused of holding opinions it dislikes is picking up speed, sowing fear, separating families, driving people to go underground or out of the country. This targeting appeals to President Trump and his followers as it bolsters three pillars of the MAGA movement. It attacks universities, long reviled as a source of liberal power. It fuels the anti-immigrant fervor long promoted by people like Trump advisor Stephen Miller, who calls them invaders. Thirdly, by targeting Palestinian solidarity activists on campus, it amplifies the false narrative that criticizing the state of Israel is anti-Semitic, even though so many of the student protesters and professor protesters are Jewish, enabling the attacks on academia while providing cover for Israel's resumed ethnic cleansing in Gaza. These students are being accused of anti-Semitism when so many of them are Jewish, and you don't have to be Jewish to care about human rights. History teaches us that standing by silently as others are disappeared is a failed strategy. As the next person grabbed off the street by masked agents of the state, maybe you. You know, I am a Jewish journalist. My grandfather was an Orthodox rabbi. He ran the Crown Heights Yeshiva in Brooklyn. He was the principal and the Yiddish rabbi there. That's on my mom's side. She went through that whole system. When she would get in trouble, she would be sent to the principal, and he'd say, Darala, what did you do? And she went on to U.S. high school and Jewish high school, Jewish Hebrew Theological College and Hunter College, tracked all the way through. My great-grandfather on my father's side was the Henry Street rabbi, came from an area now that's Ukraine. It went back and forth between Poland. My grandmother, the Rebbetzin, the wife of the Crown Heights rabbi, and she was born in Rivne, what's now Ukraine, was Poland. In 1897, she was a woman of three centuries. She died in 2005. She was 108 when she died. And my great-great-great-great-grandfather was the founder of Hasidism, the Baal Shem Tov. So, you know, I grew up steeped in Jewish history. I was always totally in awe of non-Jews in World War II who helped save Jews, my family, so many families. I mean, why would people risk everything, their own families, to save others who were targeted? And that was the feeling of my whole family. They're called the righteous, truly remarkable people. And that's what people, I don't even want to say human rights activists, but it is what fuels human rights activists. It's what people of compassion do. It's not about whether you're from Mexico or whether you're from Palestine. It's not about whether you're from Afghanistan. It is because someone is in trouble, someone is in pain. And I think we were all raised to believe that we have to be there. And I think that's the wave we've seen across college campuses throughout this past year. So I want to go back to Mahmoud Khalil, a Columbia University grad student until last December. He was first arrested March 8th. He was a legal permanent resident of the United States with a green card, which has now been revoked. His wife, Dr. Noor Abdullah, is a U.S. citizen. She's a dentist, about to give birth. She was at the time. She now has a little boy named Dean, Dean Khalil. That's their first child, expecting to give birth with her husband, with Mahmoud. 8 months pregnant, she filmed her husband's arrest in Columbia Housing. As she spoke to his lawyer on the phone, she tried to learn the identities of the arresting plainclothes agents as they dragged Mahmoud into an unmarked car. Mahmoud had joined the Palestine Solidarity protests at Columbia University last spring and was accepted by both the protesters and the administration as a negotiator. Right. He would go back and forth between them. He thus had a prominent public role in the first major protest encampment against Israel's ongoing assault on Gaza, which sparked encampments across the country. Very likely why he was targeted for deportation. A federal judge blocked his deportation while his legal teams fight for his release. Now, this story has, to say the least, since been updated. His wife gives birth at this people's graduation a few weeks ago of Columbia students who came to get their alternative diplomas. She cradled little Dean in her arms with a Palestinian flag on his baby graduation cap, and then immediately went down to Jena because her lawyers were fighting for her to be able to bring the baby and to see her husband for the first time, and he could touch his infant son. Don't forget, these people are not charged with crimes. In other places all over the country, of course you can have contact visits, but they are being so punitive. It took a battery of lawyers 48 hours with Dr. Abdullah holding the baby to get an hour visit. Their first visit together at the jail. Little baby he holds for the first time. And then he goes off to the immigration court where the immigration lawyer, you know, ultimately, so many of them sadly see themselves unlike the federal judges. They're, you know, part of the executive branch. But she was shocked by what Mahmoud had to say. When you call me a terrorist and then say you're going to deport me, I face assassination at home. I face torture. I face imprisonment. And even the judge was shocked by his words as he only turned around when he heard his baby cooing, hearing those first coos for the first time in person. I also, the next day after the people's graduation, got to go to the Columbia graduation where Mohsen Badawi graduated. Mohsen was arrested after Mahmoud. He also, a Palestinian from a West Bank refugee camp, had lived in the United States for years, was beyond green card. He was getting his citizenship right at the naturalization process going for that interview. He's a student at Columbia, and he's called to do his naturalization interview in Vermont. This was in April. He's told to come for an interview, and he's thinking, it's early. I shouldn't be coming now. It's not for months. Is it a trap? He writes to Senator Sanders, because naturalization interviews in Vermont, to Senator Welch and to Congressmember Ballant, the three representatives of the small state of Vermont. He said, I think I'm being set up, but there's no way I can't go, because then I would be blamed for not showing up. So he shows with his lawyer. He does the whole thing. He has to sign his oath to the Constitution at the end, and it's going okay. And all of a sudden, the door bursts open. Masked, hooded agents come in, and they take him away, separated from his lawyer. He's raced to the airport. He has to go to the bathroom. He has to get a drink of water. By the time he gets to the gate, his plane is pulling away. It's a commercial jet. You know, if he had been sent to the South, he could still be there. And as that plane pulls away, the judge tells the lawyer that he is not to be removed from Vermont. So he is held in a Vermont prison, and ultimately the judge rules enraged and says, we're talking about the Red Scare. We're talking about the Palmer Raids. What is happening here? He must be released. And after 14 days, he's released and comes out and says to President Trump, you know, from the steps of the courthouse, I am not afraid. I do not fear you. So he was in Vermont, and then the Columbia graduation was happening, and the judge ruled he can go to New York, could go to the graduation. So he goes to court the next day, and the judge is mad. I want to be able to read you his words, but I don't have them right here. But basically what the judge said is, he not only can go to his graduation, he can meet with members of the media, he can meet with any public official he wants to, and he can protest anywhere. You leave him be. So he comes to graduation, and as he walks across the stage with his hands and the peace sign, hugging the dean, the entire Columbia, most of the Columbia class stands up and gives him a standing ovation. That is Mohsen's story. I mean, there are so many people whose stories we can tell. In one of the most disturbing incidents, Tufts University PhD student and Fulbright scholar Ramesa Ozturk was snatched off the street in Somerville outside Boston by half a dozen masked ICE agents as she was walking to dinner with, going with friends to break the daily fast during Ramadan. She's in Somerville, right outside Tufts. The abduction caught on a neighbor's doorbell camera. A chilling demonstration of the brutal tactics being used against this vulnerable population. The day after her arrest, over 1,000 people, professors, students, community members, turned out to protest near Tufts. Tufts also issued a letter, but this mass rally demanding her release. You know, when they moved in on her, she said, I'm calling the police. She had no idea who these masked people were, and they said, we are the police. She would later tell her lawyer that one of them said, you know, afterwards, she didn't even know she had screamed. She didn't even know that's instinct to save yourself. But she told her lawyer that one of the men holding her said, we are not monsters. We are following orders. Think about that. And that's where community media comes in. As I said, a huge kitchen table that we all sit around. And why is this most critical? Also for the service members, for law enforcement, for all the people who are asking questions inside the system. They identify as well. If they hear these voices, it is our noble responsibility, an awesome responsibility that we have. This is clearly not just a job. It is a mission. So back at Columbia, right before the graduation, the protests continued. About a dozen Jewish students, the encampments were over now, but a dozen Jewish students chained themselves to two campus gates, Aharon Dardik, an Israeli-American student, saying, we as Jewish students said that we weren't going to leave until the university named who it was amongst the trustees who collaborated with the fascist Trump administration to detain our classmate, Mahmoud Khalil, and tried to deport him. That's what Aharon said. Among the signs that the students held and the professors who were supporting them, one read, first they came for Mahmoud. A reference to Pastor Martin Niemöller's famous saying from Nazi Germany that ends, and I said nothing. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak out.
You're listening to Amy Goodman on the power of community media. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
Which brings me to the enormous assault on the LGBT community right now around this country. I come from New York, and it was a Thursday when we heard that the Trump administration had just wiped from the Stonewall, it's a federal site now, you know, the launch of the modern day gay rights movement, LGBTQ movement, had erased the letter T from LGBTQ. Erase the T. who led the Stonewall Riot, as it's called, when police moved in on this little bar in the village. Oh, people like Sylvia Rivera. These were trans women with their spiked heels who took off their heels and they were hammered.